I really firmly have learned that one of the worst things that can happen with our civil society organisations is they're used to polarise people. So people in my sort of role mustn't become part of the problem.
Welcome to Communicating Purpose. I'm John Higginson, founder of purpose-led communications agency Higginson Strategy. And I believe that the best way to get a message across clearly is by talking about something you honestly and passionately believe in. By doing so, you bring people with you, your passion becomes theirs, and I call this the power of purpose. Today, I'm joined by a guest who has been named amongst the most influential 1% of the UK PR industry and is the recipient of multiple awards for her campaign work. Celia Richardson is the Director of Communications and Marketing at the National Trust, the biggest conservation charity in Europe with more than 5 million members, including nearly 1 in 10 of the UK's population. As I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar, the National Trust is one of the largest landowners in the UK, owning more than 500 historic houses, castles, monuments, gardens, and nature reserves. For the past 6 years, Celia has been responsible for the Trust brand and marketing policy, advocacy, and reputation. And she found herself at the epicenter of controversy and polarizing culture wars discourse that's been going on for the last few years, following the release of the National Trust report into its property's links to slavery. Before undertaking her current formidable role, Celia dedicated more than a decade to devising communication strategies for some of the leading mental health charities. Celia, it's a pleasure to have you on the show today. Just tell us a bit more about your own background and your journey to where you are today.
My background, goodness, well, I am born and raised in the northeast of England. So I'm quite a long way from my original home in London, but I've been living here for about 30 years. I left school. I went to do an English literature degree. I was from a low-income family and didn't realise that it's not very traditional to do English literature degrees when you're from a low-income family, because how are you going to earn a living, as everyone often asks me now when I feel a bit sad that people aren't doing English degrees very often, particularly people from low-income families. And then I left university at 21. I was in quite a lot of debt and I needed to find a job pretty quick smart. I was very lucky. My first job was at the Refugee Council. I just went into a temping agency and they sent me there. And I ended up, as often happens, staying for 3-4 years. My job was in fundraising, but I sat opposite the press office and that felt like a much better fit for me. And back in those days, you could smoke in the press office. A press office was just basically a big line of desks with ashtrays and phones and a fax machine, and I found it very attractive. It's kind of like the where all the goings on happened in the organisation. So that's when I was, 22, 23, and I've been working in communications ever since. So about 25 years and more than 25 years, I've worked in various not-for-profit organisations. I've worked in government organisations. My last job before this one was Director of Communications and Public Engagement for Historic England, which looks after the historic public realm and is an arm's length body of DCMS. So I've been doing the same job for many years, just sort of upscaling, I suppose you'd call it.
Very good. Now, all of us in comms talk about show, don't tell in terms of communications. How does the National Trust embody this with the weight of expectation that falls on you?
Yes, show, don't tell is a hugely important thing. And actually, it's probably the basis of the whole ethos of the National Trust. So if you go out, if you read a lot of stuff about the National Trust, you'll read that our job is the permanent preservation of historic buildings. Actually, our 1907 Act, which is what says that what we are legally here for, what we are here for is to promote the permanent preservation of historic buildings and places of natural beauty. And I think it's safe to say that the major impact of our work is actually on the way that we influence other people to preserve and protect things. So we own a huge amount of land, but actually it's minuscule compared to what's going on, to all the land that there is. 40% of all endangered species rely on our land, but they rely on the 98% of the rest of the land in this country. So our conservation work in land and nature is critically important, and it has a major impact on others. And I think the way that we look after buildings, the way that we encourage people to come in, the way that we encourage people to use them, do things, love them, you know, that's all part of building the conservation mindset, which I think was at the heart of what our founders were about. And, you know, the same is true in communications.
I was just going to bring to one of those points there that you kind of touch upon, which was this 2020 report on colonialism and historic slavery links to some National Trust properties. There was a strong reaction to that. Just tell us what that reaction was. Did you anticipate it, and how did you deal with it?
Yeah, of course. So the National Trust cares for buildings, and we always research the history of the places and buildings in our care. It's not just buildings, you know, we look after Cornish tin mines, and we look after Welsh mountains, and we own, I think it's a third of the Lake District, and we're constantly learning the history of the places, and we are constantly representing and working on this endeavour with the public. In 2020, we published a report. It had been in the pipeline for quite some time. As Mary Beard said in her Octavia Hill lecture just a few weeks ago, it stated the bleeding obvious. It said that 93 of the 300 to 400 properties in our care have very direct links to colonial history and historic slavery, and that you know, some of the wealth that we care for on behalf of everyone is, you know, is partly a result of this history. And we launched it. I suppose the context is really important. This was in 2020, so it was our 125th anniversary. We were all prepared for a year of celebration, starting on our birthday on January the 7th, and then by March, we were deep in the middle of a pandemic. We had to close the organisation for the first time. The National Trust is completely financially independent, so we had no direct recourse to public funds. So we were, obviously, the world was very focused on you know, that piece of work, and the public couldn't come into our properties. So everything we were doing was, you know, we didn't have that coming in and coming out, you know, every weekend. Hundreds of thousands of people are coming into National Trust places, talking to our volunteers, talking to our staff. So in this context, our relationship with, you know, the media, the public was changing as they do. In May of 2020, George Floyd was murdered. Black Lives Matter protesters and allies and others, lots of people took to the streets all over the world. And there became quite a heated debate in our national media and our national discourse, especially in the United States, but also in the UK, about all of this. And I think it's fair to say there was some quite, you know, there was strong campaigning and there was strong pushback. So we launched our report in this context. It was the September of that year. The report basically outlined these things. It was intended to help really our curators and the people responsible for the care of the properties to understand the history, and to help them to start to present the history, to add more information. I think the timing of it was really important, but there was this backlash going on. There was this belief that, you know, somebody needed to stand up for our history, just because the stuff about the protesting that had been going on, you know, started to join up with long time conversations about the historic realm, who we put on statues, who we put on plinths, do we not need to talk more about, you know, where some of the riches that we all own together came from. So these two things got very tied together. They'd been tied together for quite a long time in academic circles. You know, campaigns like Roads Must Fall, campaigns about Colston in Bristol. This was part of a public debate. So we launched into that context, and there was a very, very strong response led by the Common Sense group of MPs, a bunch of backbench Conservative MPs who wanted the Prime Minister to intervene. They wanted a political solution to ensure that their views were heard, and that maybe the National Trust was stopped from doing the research. We were called cultural Marxists. This is very familiar. I mean, this has happened to an awful lot of museums and galleries, and it's why it's called the culture war. So basically, it was a wedge issue, and it just became of huge interest to the media. And I think partly because of who the National Trust is. You know, we're a conservation organization. We're very big. We're very old. We're well known. We often are thought to represent the center ground, and change at the National Trust, even quite small change, and you know, this was one report, can sometimes set off, you know, quite strong responses, and that's what happened. We were pretty much bombarded, I would say. There was a private company set up to try to change our leadership, which, and that campaign for that goes on to this day and has metamorphosized on a number of occasions. And we, you know, had a very long run on us from a couple of newspaper titles. And I think, you know, things had changed, you know, the advent of GB News, that just some of the things that have been going on in our politics and in our media. I think Emily Maitlis nailed it when she talked about the way that populism has impacted us. It was different from previous controversies at the National Trust, because the National Trust always having, you know, some sort of controversy. It's recently we were accused of cancelling Christmas and cancelling mushrooms. We were accused of making our scones secretly woke. This has been going on for decades on a small scale, but the row over the colonialism and slavery report was bigger than we would normally expect. And that, I think, was part, we were part, it was part of history, really. It was part of what was changing in the UK.
I'd love to find out how you can make a scone woke, but I should probably ask you that. How were you accused of making a scone woke?
Oh, well, it was a bank holiday weekend, and the National Trust is where a lot of England and Wales go on a weekend. So we're always of interest on a bank holiday weekend. Our press office expects some sort of nonsense on the Thursday or Friday. So we had a call from the Daily Mail saying they'd found that we were secretly using vegetable-based spread in our scones. Now, you and I think, are old enough to remember a thing called margarine. The National Trust hasn't used butter in its tea room scones. We make millions every we serve 2 or 3 million a year. I can't remember which. So we've always used margarine or a vegetable-based spread. That's never been an issue. But for some reason, the Daily Mail wanted to say that we'd secretly changed our recipe in order to pander to vegans. Or minorities generally. I mean, you know, people who don't have dairy, yeah. I think. And, you know, what the funny thing, well, not the funny thing, that the serious thing is it would be illegal for us to, you know, keep our recipes a secret, highly illegal. And also the very funny thing for me was just that, you know, it turned out the Daily Mail had published our scone recipe 4 or 5 years before, the exact one they were railing against, saying it was scrumptious. So, you know, it was just one of those silly stories, but... Then it became a thing about us being woke and disrespecting heritage. GB News did a section on it. You know, the story ran and ran for a few days. But, yeah, it was called secret virtue signalling. I don't know how you can signal virtue secretly. But, yeah, it was one of those stories. And it's often that the question is usually, are you serving this part of the nation and not that part of the nation? So this idea that we've changed something in order to serve a different part of the nation, here being vegans or people who don't eat dairy for whatever reason, it had the hallmarks of a good old story. And, you know, the scone's pretty iconic. So why wouldn't you choose the scone if you wanted to have a cultural war story? Yeah.
Well, I think it's a good point. It sounds like a silly story, but I think it points out the bigger factor there, that the nation feels that they own the National Trust, even if they're not one of those 10% that are actually members, because it's National Trust, it's got nation in the title, and there's that feeling of it's actually almost a part of national ownership or government or something like that. And so being as large as you are, you have to take these pops, it sounds like. But going back to the more kind of serious stories, are there lessons that you've taken from this stuff over the last few years that you're bringing forward now and communicating in a different way?
For sure. I mean, what you say is absolutely true. The National Trust not only feels as if it belongs to the nation, it does belong to the nation. Yes, we have a membership and we're very, very, you know, I'm a proud member, but the National Trust is set up to benefit the whole of society. And I think the most important thing is I really firmly have learned that one of the worst things that can happen with our civil society organisations is they're used to polarise people. They're used to drive wedges between people. You know, we live in a very polarized time. I think that's very dangerous and very difficult. So people in my sort of role mustn't become part of the problem. You have to work very hard in order to ensure that when you're embattled, don't make a mistake, you know, don't disrespect your critics. Some critics are, of course, in good faith. Some people feel strongly about all kinds of change, and you mustn't lump everyone together and, you know, believe that there's a conspiracy against you. I think you must listen to people and you must always speak respectfully, never insult your opponents. My approach personally has always been to correct misinformation and disinformation and tell the absolute truth as best we can about what's going on behind the scenes, but not to insult or disrespect people who share a viewpoint because, you know, we live in a pluralistic society and that's part of what the National Trust's about. So really careful about that. I suppose the other thing is really paying attention to all the inaccuracies. I think there was a point when we were pretty much deluged with inaccuracies and we were getting that thing called the Woozle effect, where something becomes true just because it's been repeated so often. And then our press team, led by the fantastic Caroline Sigley, took an approach of correcting everything, putting their backs into it, making sure that every time the editor's code was breached with an inaccuracy, there was a correction one, until I think newspapers realised that we did care and we would keep ensuring that the truth was told.
Great. Just tell us a bit about your long-term vision for the National Trust communications and marketing strategy.
Long-term vision is about, expanding. It's increasing and diversifying our audiences. The thing about any national institution, but particularly one with a mission like ours, which is so broad. So our mission really is to get conservation action everywhere. You know, we're living in a time of a climate crisis and a biodiversity crisis. And, you know, we don't have, you know, we have some of the tools to deal with that, not all of them, but we need everyone's support. So I think our long-term ambition is to broaden our base of support. Now, that might sound really ambitious when we've already got, you know, we're heading for 6 million members and we'll soon be the biggest membership organisation in Europe. But I think we also have to be thinking about how to broaden further. You know, will our membership, you know, model always attract everyone? No. You know, we sometimes attract donors who aren't members. We attract volunteers. It's great if they are members, but what we're trying to do is ensure that the mission goes everywhere. We're not always successful yet in cities. We aren't as well known in cities as we are in rural areas. That stands to reason. Most of the places where we're working are in rural areas. And what we need to do is ensure that, you know, as a conservation organisation, people can feel as if they can do something. They can be part of the conservation movement wherever they live. So at the moment, you know, we're just making sure that we are serving audiences that we've previously underserved. And what we're trying to do is make people feel as if they can do something. You know, we live in quite hopeless times in some ways. We have a lot of people sort of in despair, really, about climate and nature. But there's an awful lot that individuals can do on their own, in communities, in neighbourhoods. So we're looking at, you know, small things people can do, as well as the bigger thing, which is joining, being a member, staying a member, regularly visiting us. So really, it's that broadening our appeal, broadening our supporter base, because it's not really about the National Trust, it's about our mission, which is conservation.
Looking back over your career, have there been any times that a message has just not landed how you've thought at all and been a bit of a failure?
I'm trying to think of a message not landing at all. I mean, of course, we've all had stories that just haven't quite reached people in the way that we hoped. I think one of the things that I've learned in my career is you can have a really great story in your head and a really great idea for how it can be done. But, you know, often you have to work with others. You have to be pluralistic about ideas and stories. You have to ensure that, you know, you're working from the time when you tell your mates in the pub about something and you see whether they're interested, you know, you're already on a mission. And then I think you've really got to go and win support for it in your team. You know, I can't just suddenly land an idea on people and have them all support it. There's something about ideas being a synthesis of different people's thinking. That's when stories work really well. They can fall a bit flat when they sound exciting to you and you're just working inside your own bunker.
Yeah. And I think I like that point there that you make, that you're testing out your ideas when you're speaking to your friends about them. And I remember the first editor that I worked for on a local paper when I was on a local said, which are the stories that people are going to be talking about in the pub? And if you just think about it that way, that's really the difference between an interesting story, a story that's going to make it, and one that isn't. So it's a really nice, simple way of working out, is this an interesting story? Because sometimes when we're in a particular area, something can seem interesting, but actually if you tried raising it with a friend who didn't know your industry and didn't know your area, they'd go, that's absolutely dead boring. And so it's not really a story at all. So a good tip on that.
Too complex to carry. We used to call it the My Dad test, basically.
Yes.
When it's too complex to carry, you know, you've got to tell people a story and it takes you like, if it takes you more than a few seconds to get to warm them up, you're not there. You haven't finished yet. I think the other thing about stories is just, you know, how you tell them. So, you know, the great big lesson for over the last year is how long the post office, it's actually Caroline Sigley, our head of media, who mentioned this recently, how long the post office scandal has been going on, but it did take dramatization in order to get that story through. And I think that choosing the method of which you tell, by which you tell the story, is incredibly important. You know, stories have to reach people in the right way at the right time. And I think that dramatization of the post office story has been such a big lesson to people who work in the communications industry.
Absolutely. And it was a great one for TV as well, which TV has been having a very hard time of late and, you know, bashed from all over the place and people not watching live TV. So I was so pleased for them getting that great, wonderful hit that achieved something really positive for those people and showing that actually drama sometimes is one of the best lobbying tools and communications tools. As you say there, that's a long format as well. It doesn't all have to be a message that fits within a tweet. Yeah, I think that's a great example. What do you feel that you've done that's made the biggest difference?
In my 30s, late 20s, early 30s, I was in my first director of communications job in a medium-sized mental health charity. And we ran a campaign based on really, really good insight from scientists, trying to help GPs to replace them. GPs were meant to first prescribe exercise therapy for patients with depression. With mild to moderate depression before they went to antidepressants. And there were all sorts of wonderful reasons for that. But, you know, we're talking 15, 20 years ago, and it wasn't happening. We just had the whole SSRI thing when you got the Prozac thing, which was a really big cultural thing. Prozac was being sold in long before it was available to the public in very subtle ways. And Prozac really changed the game. And we had an increasing number of people taking an increasing number of antidepressants. There's nothing wrong with antidepressants. They can be absolutely amazing. But exercise therapy actually had the same or better performance in all clinical trials. And it also has positive side effects. It's a habit for life and it's very good for people. So it was outperforming antidepressants, but there wasn't any money behind it. We didn't have, you know, sales teams going out and knocking on GPs' doors and showing them their data and statistics the way that we did with antidepressants. So we tried to replicate that a little bit. We ran a really focused campaign just on GPs. We showed that they, you know, most GPs, we did surveys showing that they weren't actually using the NICE guidance. And what we did was we got a sales team together to go to GP conferences to show the exercise data and to show the positive benefits. And it's a very long story, but it was a very focused campaign. It wasn't a big spend of money, but we really focused on news. We managed to tip the news agenda. And I think it genuinely did. That's the campaign where I know if I went into my GP surgery now and I had moderate or mild depression, I know that it's very likely my GP would offer me exercise therapy because it's available an awful lot more now because we worked on the supply as well as the demand side. And I think that really, I mean, there were other people obviously working in that area, but I think that one campaign that we ran really was a bit of a turning point.
Yeah, what a great example. And you're absolutely right. The generation below us really, really understand the value of exercise as well. I think you'll find as well as GPs being better at recommending it. What do you do yourself to unwind? You've got a very stressful job.
Well, I've got two teenage sons, so I don't unwind that easily. I'm kind of wound up a lot of the time at home, as one is when living with teenagers. They are fantastic. To unwind, well, I'm in a book club with a lot of other women. I am a very big consumer of podcasts. I like to walk. I swim. I love to listen to podcasts. I listen to things like the News Agents. I listen to The Rest is Politics, The Rest is History, all the standard popular podcasts. I swim a lot, actually, and I think that's one of the things about a job as busy as mine. I've got a lot going on from morning till night, and a lot of different things coming in. And when I'm in the water, I'm on my own. It's like meditation, because I can't meditate, but I can swim. So I swim as often as I can at about 6:30 in the morning. And the other thing I do, I'm sorry, John, I'm a PR from the 90s. I often unwind with gossip and white wine.
Yeah, don't we all? If there was one message that you could give to your younger self, what would it be?
Actually, normally I would probably berate myself and tell myself to do more of something or less of something. I think the thing that I've done quite well in my career today is take risks. I'd mean both, you know, taking risks with my career, maybe leaving a job for one that didn't seem terribly obvious to other people, but I could see the reward. And I also think taking professional risks. You can't get reward without risk, or you very often can't. And I've seen people playing it safe. And you know, that's not how you build excellence in your working life. So I'd say I've probably taken the right level of risk. I've been helped along the way, to be honest, because it's quite a long story, but I've had two very, very sick children, and they're both alive and well now. But I think one of the things that really influenced me was that I almost lost my career twice. I was very unlucky in that my children were very unlucky in that they were both very ill. And that normally or very often sort of spells the end of a woman's career. And I'm very fortunate, that we were able to get them well again, and B, that my partner, my husband, was always 50-50. And we had a really supportive family who helped us get through those hard times. And I think, like anything, when you're threatened with the loss of something, obviously the first and most important thing was making sure that the kids were well. But that thought of not being able to work just really was stunningly difficult. And I really don't know what it's like for women who do end up, or men who end up, having to choose. And of course, you know, if your child's very unwell, you'll always choose to care for your child. But I think that loss, it feels quite profound when you think you're facing it. And I think it meant that when the children got well again both times, I took a career risk pretty quickly afterwards, and it was just part of that do it while you can, and that something else might be around the corner.
Celia Richards, Director of Communications and Marketing at National Trust. We're all very glad that you have got through that, and that you are able to put your time into your career as well as what sounds like a very difficult home life over the last few years. You've been speaking to me, John Higginson, on Communicating Purpose. If you'd like to know more about how Higginson Strategy supports purpose-led organisations, please visit higginsonstrategy.com. Thank you, Celia.